This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor. Happy Friday. South Africa has a new president. Jacob Zuma succumbed to pressure to step down amid a cloud of corruption allegations. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Defense Secretary Jim Mattis meet Turkish officials over their conflicting goals in Syria. Also, in the wake of a sexual exploitation scandal, the British charity Oxfam vows to, in its words, atone for the past, and North and South Korea melt a little of the ice in their relationship at the Winter Olympics. Lots to talk about in the Friday News Roundup. Here with us in Washington, far from us here at Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor, is Nadia Bilbasi, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya. Nadia, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Josh.
Susan Glasser, Politico's Chief International Affairs Columnist. Susan, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
We also welcome your questions and thoughts about the week's top stories. Email 1A at WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page, where you can also watch our video stream, or tweet us at 1A. Let's begin with South Africa, where its President Jacob Zuma resigned this week after mounting political pressure over his personal corruption scandals. He resigned hours before a vote of no confidence was scheduled to take place. Here is what Mr. Zuma said to the public on Wednesday.
I have therefore come to the decision to resign as President of the Republic with immediate effect. Even though I disagree with the decision of the leadership of my organization, I have always been a disciplined member of the ANC.
The ANC, the African National Congress, the political party that Jacob Zuma belonged to, the party of Nelson Mandela, that was President Zuma speaking after resigning on Wednesday. Susan Glasser, he was clearly reluctant to step down, but remind us what led to the resignation.
Well, you alluded to it, and I think this is an important story. I'm glad we're talking about it first. Toxic levels of corruption, a government that has ceased functioning in any meaningful way. The number that sticks with me this morning is 27%. That is the employment rate in South Africa today.
I'm sorry. 27% is the unemployment
rate? That's correct.
My goodness. Wow.
Right? I mean, that's just an extraordinary figure. It speaks to basically a collapse of the ability to govern the country. And the reason, though, specifically that President Zuma in the end was forced to resign, he said it in his statement, the decision of my party, the ANC. And this is a country where party in many ways still trumps government or trumps state. And so he'll be succeeded by one of the key founding members of the African National Congress, Cyril Ramaphosa, who was his deputy, who ironically has become in recent years sort of a huge oligarch almost of South Africa, one of the wealthiest men on the continent, but one of the heroes of the anti-apartheid movement.
Nadia Bilbasi, talk a little bit more about Cyril Ramaphosa. What's his story? He's a leader in the ANC, former deputy president. Susan alluded to his wealth, but what more do we know about him, particularly as it relates to why the ANC believed that he was the man to lead South Africa forward?
Well, basically, he represents the old generation of Mandelas, if you wish, the people who fought the battle against apartheid. But after Mandela came to power, he decided to become a businessman. So now he's been looked at as the savior of South Africa. He's basically a reformist. People believe that under his tenure that South Africa will rise again. It has a terrible record, not just of unemployment, but of crime. It's the highest in the world. AIDS infection, for example, although it declined, but the number of AIDS patients has risen from like 4 million to 7 million between 2002 and 2016. The world has lost confidence in business and investment, although Goldman Sachs now think there is a chance, actually, that South Africa will come back under Ramaphosa. He has a good reputation. The first task for him is to unite the ANC. The ANC did very badly in local election. They're going to office election in 2019. So for him, it just basically put the party together and then look at the enormous problems that South Africa is facing, especially among the young generation. There is one statistic, actually, I came across, which is horrifying, that 8 out of 10 9-year-old South Africans are illiterate. Yeah, basically, they are illiterate. The townships are still functioning with no sanitation, with no health clinics, with no running water. The disparity between the very rich and the very poor, the township, is the legacy of apartheid. For these young people, they needed somebody who is a businessman, who understands how to bring South Africa from the brink of collapse. Zuma was a terrible president by any account, and now there is a good opportunity for him to do well. But again, he is functioning against all odds. And I think he's actually one quote that I also seen. He said that basically now we are coming out of period of uncertainty, period of darkness, and getting into a new phase. So I'll say good luck to Cyril Ramaphosa.
We're speaking to Nadia Bilbasi of Al Arabiya and Susan Glasser of Politico on the Friday News Roundup. We'd love to hear from you, too. What stories from around the world have caught your attention, and what questions do you have about them? You're welcome to share your thoughts with us today or at any time about what's got you captivated in the news around the world. Email 1A@WAMU.org. Nadia, I don't want to linger on South Africa too long. There's lots more we'd like to discuss, but what about the opposition? Not everyone is a member of the ANC, and you alluded to the fact that the ANC was really struggling with local elections. How have opposition leaders reacted to Cyril Ramaphosa becoming the new president, especially because their party is not in power, and to what his agenda is?
Absolutely. I mean, they definitely wanted to see somebody who is a technocrat, who is able to help everyone, not just the ANC, but the ANC has dominated South African politics since the end of, well, during the struggle and the end of apartheid and Mandela's coming to power, for sure. But we haven't seen the leader of the caliber of Mandela, and maybe this is Cyril Ramaphosa will be the closest that they have seen, and therefore I think the opposition will give him a chance. They will be united behind him, considering that his background, he's wealthy enough that he doesn't need to be marred in corruption that marked the tenure of Jacob Zuma. So unemployment level, it just Susan alluded to that, not just 27%, but it's 68% among the youth, which is staggering by any standard. So I think the opposition will welcome that. We will see. But the fact that actually Zuma stepped down 1 year before his time ends, that's a good sign. And the fact now they have to get to work together will be another indication of how the country can be united behind Cyril Ramaphosa.
Before we move on from South Africa, Susan, I have to wonder about the idea of being the president as part of the party of Nelson Mandela. I feel, and this may feel like a weird comparison, but I think about a lot of Democrats after Barack Obama left office and Donald Trump took office, dreaming about who they would like to be the next Democratic president to get back to those Obama-esque days. And that feels like an impossibly high standard. It seems even more impossibly high to be the president as part of the party of Nelson Mandela, because there'll never be another Nelson Mandela. Mm. How much do you feel like the legacy of Mandela is part of South Africa's forward progress? They have very basic kitchen table needs, but there's never going to be another Mandela. How does that factor into this?
You know, Joshua, I think I'm glad you brought that up, because I agree with you that that's one of those examples where, on the one hand, the Mandela legacy can keep powering the party forward and to stay in power. I think looking at the pictures, in fact, of Cyril Ramaphosa today, you know, people recirculating, news organizations running pictures of him. He was the head and founder of one of the key trade unions that worked with Mandela and the ANC as part of in the culminating years of the anti-apartheid struggle. So he has these impeccable credentials that, in fact, are drawn from his work hand in hand with Mandela. He was a key partner, by the way, in drafting South Africa's constitution, in working alongside Mandela and negotiating with the apartheid regime to end, peacefully to end that regime. And so, you know, his credentials to govern, in fact, are absolutely rooted in his connection to this great leader, as you pointed out, who looms so large over South African politics. The flip side is, right, there's a point at which all revolutions, even peaceful ones, run out of the gas that their founders or their founding party sustained them on. And they need to find a new political identity rooted in their ability to actually govern the country. You know, now this can go on for decades. I'm thinking of, say, Mexico, where I believe it was 7 decades of more or less one-party rule that ended, in the 90s. And that was a necessary stage to come up with a more robust and multi-party democratic system. And that, of course, South Africa will need at some point to do that, to show that it can have a robust multi-party system in which the ANC can at some point turn over power or evolve into a different party, because otherwise it's just going to be a one-party rule.
We have to pause in a moment. Matt asks, when did South Africa spiral into insolvency? Nadia, can you give us a real quick answer to that before we break? Was there a turning point when South Africa began to go the wrong way?
Yes, I think it was during Thabo Mbeki, which is the second president that took after Mandela. And again, he didn't really deliver. Corruption was very high among government officials. As I said, the main problems that Mandela inherited during the apartheid regime, with the segregation, with the big township like Soweto, lack of services like healthcare, etc., lack of confidence in investors in South Africa has started, I think, in the late 90s.
We'll continue the Friday News Roundup with Nadia Bilbasi of Al Arabiya and Susan Glasser of Politico in just a moment, and we'll get to more of your questions and thoughts as well. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you from Ann Arbor, Michigan. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup, and we welcome your questions and thoughts about the week's top stories from around the world. Comment on our Facebook page, where you can watch our video stream, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is being called upon by demonstrators to resign after police recommended he be charged with bribery in 2 corruption cases. We spoke about Mr. Netanyahu's future this week with Natan Gutman, our friend from Israeli Public Television and The Forward. You'll find that conversation on our website, the1a.org. That's the word the number one, the letter a.org. For now, we continue the roundup with Nadia Bilbasi, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya, Susan Glasser, Politico's Chief International Affairs Columnist, and we're also joined by NPR Pentagon Correspondent Tom Bowman. Tom, welcome back to 1A.
Hey, Joshua.
I'm glad you're here, because I did want to talk to you about Syria. Unless a miracle occurs, this spring, Syria will enter its 8th year of civil war. This week, there were troubling signs that the worst is yet to come. The conflict endures, it broadens. Active participation by the U.S. and Russia and Turkey and Iran and Israel seems to be threatening to destabilize the entire region and possibly beyond. Now, Tom Bowman, you just got back from a reporting trip to Syria. What did you learn?
Well, I learned that it's probably more complex than people had ever imagined. I remember last fall people saying when Raqqa fell, people at the Pentagon were telling me, Tom, now the really difficult part begins. But I don't think anybody even at that time realized how widespread this would become and pull in some of the great powers. You have Israel striking Iranian locations, Turkey taking on the Kurdish fighters. You have the United States now striking Russian mercenaries. It's just, I don't want to say spiraling out of control, but it is much more complex, and the tensions are just rising all the time. Of course, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is over in Turkey talking with President Erdogan. Jim Mattis will be talking, the defense secretary will be talking to his counterparts. And we'll just see what happens. I mean, Turkey does not want what the U.S. wants, which is to give the Kurds some sort of autonomy in Syria, the next government. And Turkey sees all of these Kurdish fighters as part of the terrorist group PKK in Turkey, and they want to just push them out of all of northern Syria. I think what the Pentagon is talking about is some sort of a buffer zone in the north, particularly in northwest part of Syria around Afrin, where you see a lot of the fighting going on. Is that possible? And when people start talking about buffer zones, the Pentagon always says, well, who's going to keep make it a buffer zone that takes people on the ground?
And Tom, when you say buffer zone, explain exactly what that is. Are we talking about a zone with no fighting?
Right,
or what
some sort of a no man's land, some sort of a peaceful section along the border with Turkey, or maybe just along the area in Afrin where the main fighting is going on right now. We've also heard talk at the Pentagon about perhaps international troops policing that area. I'm not sure who they would be and in what numbers. So we'll see what comes out of these talks. There's no sense yet of any breakthrough. I know Tillerson went back to his hotel and didn't want to talk to reporters. That's always a sign of things aren't going all that great.
Tom, I feel like the more that I learn about Syria and the more I hear you and Nadia and others and Susan and others talk about Syria, the less inclined I am to think of it as purely a civil war. This is just starting to feel like war. It's the civil war among Syrians. There are these proxy wars involving, as you just mentioned, Turkey and Kurdish fighters. This seems like that's part of the complication of it, that everyone who's involved wants a different thing, and Syria is just kind of the common land at which everyone is fighting over whatever it is that they want.
No, I think that's right, and I think Russia wants to maintain its influence there. Iran is now moving in to try to gain some sort of influence there, and the Kurds are just looking for some sort of an autonomous area as part of the Syrian state. And the Americans want to first destroy ISIS. They say that will take another 2 to 6 months. And then the U.S. says what they want to do is stay in Syria to prevent the return of what they call ISIS 2.0 and to make sure the Kurds get something out of the Geneva peace talks. Now, that raises a question about the legality of all this. And some international lawyers, I talked to Rosa Brooks over at Georgetown. Now, the UN resolution said we want member states to do away with these safe havens in Syria. But what happens when the safe havens come to an end? And the United States says we just want to stay here, maintaining their presence, in which basically one quarter of the Syrian state. Were the questions of sovereignty and so forth that no one really is raising except Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia. Congress is basically silent in all of this. And Tim Kaine is saying, where is this all going? Is this going to turn into a wider war? Nobody is addressing that question.
Nadia Bilbasi, there was reporting from Reuters that stated that the 300 men working for a Kremlin-linked Russian private military firm were killed or injured in Syria last week. What more do we know about them?
Well, we know now there's actually mercenaries who work in Syria. It's not just the regional powers that Tom just mentioned, but also there is people who are willing to kill and die for money. And for the first time, actually, this has come to a light that basically 15 Russians, as you said, they were killed in this attack on an arms depot in an area called Deir ez-Zor. Some of these Russians, from the things that I read about them, they did it for nationalistic reasons, which is very analogous situation to the war of Iraq, the invasion of Iraq, that basically they were motivated by the fact they wanted to fight ISIS so they don't come to Russia. But most of them, they do it for money, basically, especially from this little town in Russia where the average wage was something like $500 a month, and then they lured in to go and work in Syria for triple that amount. And even if you have an experience in the military, you get even 10 times this amount of money. So it's not just that the Russians never acknowledged that they actually, they've been using these contractors, it's called the Wagner Group, and bring them into Syria, apart from, of course, this talking about Russian military being involved there. And they have some Russian fatalities there. But the first time, actually, that we're talking about these mercenaries and their wives and their families have been asking the criminal to come clean about this and to talk into to inform the public of what's going on there. And this is not, this is part of the war, basically. We've seen the Americans, too, in Blackwater and other groups, security groups that they worked in Iraq and on behalf of the military contractors, etc. But it adds another dimension into this murky of the Syrian war that it draws everybody into it. It's not just the Syrian who believes that it's not a civil war because every other country was involved. This is a regional war that involves regional powers who wanted to exercise their influence.
And if I could just add, Joshua, the death toll is much higher than that. We were there when this attack took place. We were 100 miles north, and we were able to talk to Turkish officers and American officers. They say dozens, if not scores, of Russian mercenaries were killed. They work for this group called Wagner. And that entire force that took on the attack, the Kurdish outpost with American advisors here, was 500 strong. They had tanks, they had artillery, they had rocket systems. Clearly, people who use those kinds of things have experience. You just don't have some ragtag militia member operating a tank or artillery. We talked to one Turkish general, a Kurdish general, and he said they saw the Russian forces massing, the Russian mercenaries. They called the Russian coordinator, because they're deconflicting operations, and asked them about this, and they said, there's nothing going on. They said, well, we're seeing these forces mass. The attack started, they called again, and the Russian said, I don't know what you're talking about. The Russian was 6 miles away when this was all going on. They kept calling throughout the attack, which went on for more than 30 hours. And then after it was over, Joshua, the Russian called them and said, can we collect our dead?
See, that kind of gets to a comment we got from a listener. And Susan Glasser, maybe you chime in on this one. Sandby wrote on our website, the1a.org, I wish the media wouldn't call these Russian irregular troops mercenaries. That word implies that the soldiers don't take orders from the Kremlin, which is what Putin wants us to think. We shouldn't kid ourselves. This is part of Putin's hybrid warfare. The purpose of these irregulars is to allow the Russian ruler to wage war without the international community or the Russian people catching on to what he is doing. He's doing the same thing in Ukraine. Susan, what do you think?
Well, I think the commentator is absolutely right. It's straight out of the playbook that the Kremlin has operated on in Ukraine. And by the way, as in Syria, the level of conflict is not necessarily as intense, but that war continues to this day. It is basically a series of militias that include Russian soldiers that the Russians do not acknowledge to be fighting under their command and control, but clearly are. And that conflict has continued without any real hopes of a resolution. In fact, it was just the third anniversary of the so-called Minsk Agreement, which was supposed to freeze and offer a path out of the fighting. Of course, that hasn't happened. In Syria, I think it's very significant. And I think you can call somebody a mercenary, by the way, and they can also be under the control. They're soldiers for hire is the term. And I think that's a very accurate reflection of what is going on here. You know, this dynamic that Tom described of the sort of like geopolitical cesspool in Syria, in which so many different outside forces are operating for their own agendas. Now, that's been going on for a number of years. And in fact, it was the Russian intervention in a stepped up way on behalf of the Assad regime, along with that of the Iranians. This has been going on for a number of years. And they were actually able to stop the tide of the war, which was running against Assad. And so now you have almost a situation where Assad regained the upper hand, but is not fully able to consolidate a victory and to actually be strong enough to kick out either these outside forces that are still operating, the Kurds, the American-backed fighters, the Turks themselves are in there. So Assad has not achieved a level of control over his own territory that enables him to claim a full victory. And of course, there's no meaningful political process. I'm struck by a couple things that I think are worth mentioning right now in this context. Tom alluded to it. Just in the last few weeks, we have seen this stepped up level of activity, not only this very, very bloody battle in which a large number of Russian casualties are reported, but also this Israeli intervention, which is significant. Also, the Turks and their stepped up concerns. The Iranians, of course, are involved. And then there's the American factor. The U.S. policy under President Trump, Secretary Tillerson, is very, very unclear. I think that's very important to point out. At this point, I don't think I could tell you, in fact, what it is beyond an open-ended statement that we will remain there because we don't want to leave and see the return of an ISIS 2.0 or an al-Qaeda-like situation. But the ability of the United States to impose its will or to convene a political process that it leads in some way basically has disappeared. We've lost both the moral authority and the stakes of having a strong enough fighting force on the ground to be able to impose any kind of a settlement on any of the players. And so Russia has had the upper hand in those kind of negotiations, but they also have proven unable to forge a peace. President Putin has tried, by the way. He convened all the players a couple times in Russia recently.
Switching.
Right.
So
right.
I think it's basically a disaster. For all concerned.
And then, here's the other question. Here's the other question, too, is the Geneva talks. And the Americans are putting a lot of stake in Geneva. We want to stay until the Geneva talks take hold. Well, if I'm Assad or if I'm the Russians, I can just say, yeah, I'll go to Geneva. I'll talk for a little while. Oh, I can't make the next meeting. Maybe I'll go to the one 6 months from now. They could string this along for months, if not years. Meanwhile, the Americans are sitting there spending money. $1 billion, Joshua, is being spent right now in northeast Syria, mostly on humanitarian aid, but small projects like getting the electric system going, getting the drinking water going, and clearing out canals. That's not going to end anytime soon. And the estimates from American officers there are it's going to take at least another year to stabilize northeast Syria. And let's close the loop on those Russian mercenaries. And clearly they are mercenaries technically. They could be controlled by the Kremlin, and they probably are, but they're mercenaries. They were heading toward the oil fields. That was where they were going. And that's important to note. Those oil fields are being now held by Kurdish rebels. And Assad could rightly say, well, hang on a second. Those are Syrian government oil fields. Why are you people hanging onto my oil fields?
Tom, but I want to close the loop on Syria before we keep going. And you kind of alluded to it in terms of what the U.S. is doing in Syria. It sounds like the prospects for an end game are getting dimmer and dimmer. Both Secretary of State Mattis, Secretary of Defense Mattis and Secretary of State Tillerson have said that the U.S. troops would stay even after ISIS is defeated. Does this mean that we, the American people, should just kind of settle in to being in Syria in one capacity or another? Or is there still hope for some kind of an exit strategy, an end game, an end to all of our involvement in Syria?
Well, the end game apparently is some sort of a new government or transitioning away from Assad. I don't think anybody sees that happening anytime soon. What do the Kurds get out of this? Do they get a semi-autonomous area in the northeast part of the country? Those are just open questions. But I don't think anyone thinks this is going to end anytime soon. And again, as I said, there's only one person in Congress really talking about this, and that's Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia. Congress isn't even asking these hard questions. What do you mean we're going to stay there to prevent the return of ISIS 2.0?
Well, remember that President Obama asked for an authorization for military force for exactly this reason. Congress didn't act on it in the last Congress. President Trump has basically not taken that kind of effort seriously. So
Congress doesn't want to own this. Let's be honest.
Well, Congress is not going to own it. This is an issue of a military action, and the executive branch more or less is going to own it one way or the other, and that's where you have this basic conflict between President Trump and his advisors once again surfacing. You have a Pentagon that's determined, and that has more or less been pretty consistent with the policy, at least of the last couple years of the Obama administration when it comes to Syria and emphasizing and prioritizing the fight against ISIS in both Iraq and Syria.
My question is, why isn't Congress holding hearings on this? Why aren't members of Congress talking about the way ahead here? If Mattis and Tillerson come out and say, we're just going to stay there,
I know we have to pause in just a minute, but I want to make sure we don't miss your point. It sounds like from what you're saying, the fact that we are not hearing Congress talking about this is not just, oh, we're distracted with the latest scandal out of Washington. They're not discussing this.
That's right.
No, but I think also an important point, which is the small foothold, the difference between, for example, the previous wars like Iraq, when you have 100 at one stage, 120,000 U.S. troops, very visible. You see demonstration, I remember, in Washington every other weekend in the White House demanding that why we are in the Middle East. And that was the point for President Trump when he came. We spent $7 trillion in the Middle East and we haven't seen any results. Now we have special forces and that's the difference. And I think there's up to 2,000 special forces in Syria. They can stay indefinitely and nobody would raise a question about them.
Well, we are going to continue the Friday News Roundup in just a moment with Nadia Bilbasi of Al Arabiya, NPR's Tom Bowman, and Politico's Susan Glasser. We're going to shift gears from the troubles of the world and talk about the Winter Olympics, something a little bit lighter. But the troubles of the world have a way of following the athletes wherever they go. The world is still spinning, after all. We'll talk Olympics in a minute. Stay close. Before we get back to the roundup, we would love your help with Monday's program about how we teach America's history, specifically how we teach about slavery. The topic is one often explored through TV series like Roots or movies like 12 Years a Slave. But in the classroom, teachers find an array of ways to talk about this, some of which are inaccurate or thoughtless, or both. How did you learn about slavery? What did teachers do to explain it to you? And how well, or poorly, did the lesson go? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. We'd also love to hear from you if you are an educator. How are you teaching about slavery today? Have there been mistakes made, or is it going well? Tell us your story, 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212, and we will share some of your stories Monday on 1A. Back now to the Friday News Roundup with NPR's Tom Bowman, Susan Glasser of Politico, and Nadia Bilbasi of Al Arabiya. One more question on Syria before we keep going. Hazem writes on Twitter, why do we let the Hezbollah and Iran fight in Syria? What happened to the Hezbollah classification as a terrorist organization? It seems like when it comes to Syria, everything goes. It's a world war on Syrian lands and the Syrian people's lives. Nadia, what about that?
Absolutely. I mean, they have no control. Who's going to stop Iran and Hezbollah? And basically, it was the one who saved the Assad regime in 2012. Otherwise, he would have been finished by then. It was the Battle of Qasir that Hezbollah fighters, very seasoned fighters, came to save him. And the Iranians, ever since, they have these Shiite militias that they drawn from Afghanistan and Pakistan and elsewhere. And for them, it is a very strategic importance to be in Syria. And I think I remember once Qasem Soleimani, which is a very famous leader of the Revolutionary Guard, said that they'd rather lose part of Iran than lose in Syria. So you can see the importance of Syria to the Iranians and to Hezbollah. But, I mean, on top of that, you have the Russians. And this is another complication. Although recently, as we just talked about this, the Middle East becoming also almost on the brink of war with the Israelis attacking this Iranian drone that crossed into the territory, and the Syrian Air Force shooting down for the first time an Israeli F-16, that the Israelis retaliated against Iranian command center in central Syria. And it basically, there was a secret channel between Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, and President Putin trying to figure out what they can do for the absence of the American leadership in doing anything meaningful in Syria in particular. So basically, the Israelis and the Russians were trying to work together to stop a further escalation. But the problem is Iran, and the Russians also need to stay and to have a base in Syria, but they have to be friends with the Iranians, and that's a dilemma. And recently we heard General Mattis saying that recently, actually, in the NATO summit, the security summit in the last few days, he basically said that Syria is for the Syrians and Iraq is for the Iraqis, and there is no place for Hezbollah, there's no place for the Iranians. But this is words, it's only rhetoric. I mean, who's going to force Iran and Hezbollah to leave Syria when the Syrian regime needs them? It's an existential threat for them, and without them, they will collapse.
And also, the Iranians were invited in by the Syrians.
True, because they have
as were the Russians, unlike the Americans. And the Americans, Secretary of Defense Mattis is concerned, as others are, about some sort of a land bridge from Lebanon going through Syria, through Iraq, back into Iran. That's the real concern. They want to check Iranian influence. I'm not sure how they can pull that off. Again, if Syria invited in Iran, you're going to see a lot more problems with Israel, clearly, in the coming weeks and months.
Israel has fought several wars already against Hezbollah. And so one of the things that you're seeing, this stepped up activity by the outside powers, is almost a fight over the terms of the peace. And if Assad is going to stay in power, now what's happening is the outside powers are litigating basically how that's going to look. And for Israel, Hezbollah being strengthened is unacceptable. You mentioned briefly Prime Minister Netanyahu and whether he's going to end up being indicted or not. One of the interesting things that is now a discussion in the Israeli press is whether you could face a wag the dog type scenario in which a prime minister who is under threat of political threat, losing his coalition possibly, being indicted, moves more aggressively against Hezbollah. He's always been, as you know, a very strong on security prime minister. Having Hezbollah both on the Syrian border with Israel and in Lebanon is something that I think in long term would be basically unsustainable for the Israelis.
And they struck the Iranian base at Palmyra. Yeah. And you could see more of that in the coming weeks and months, certainly.
Absolutely. I think Israel cannot tolerate Iran being on the border. They lived with Hezbollah for decades.
Right.
And by the way, they've been able to carry attacks, I think up to 300 attacks that the Syrians don't acknowledge, or sometimes they said we have the right to respond whenever we want. But the Israelis will not allow Iranians to have a base there. And hence, we saw this retaliation recently against Iranians who apparently many people were killed, but the Iranians won't even acknowledge that there were casualties by the Israelis. So we have to watch this very closely.
Well, it's great to get all this deep context on Syria. There's more we want to discuss in the roundup. We may come back to Syria just briefly before our time is up, but there are a few more stories we'd like to get to, including one out of the world of nonprofits. One of the largest charities in Britain, Oxfam, is dealing with a big public scandal. Back in 2011, the national director for Oxfam in Haiti and senior workers there hired prostitutes while in Haiti for relief efforts after the catastrophic earthquake there. The deputy chief executive, Penny Lawrence, stepped down on Monday for how the situation was handled. Susan Glasser, what's happened here? What's going on with Oxfam?
Well, look, I don't have a lot of insight to add in terms of, you know, the internal organization's dynamics. A couple thoughts occur. Number one, obviously, you see the spreading of the Me Too movement and a new level of accountability and scrutiny of what was previously be considered the internal actions, whether it's of NGOs or government agencies or even political institutions. So on the one hand, I think you see this movement spreading around the world. The idea that what could just be handled quietly and internally was not part of scrutiny has really changed in a fairly dramatic way in a short amount of time. And I think that most people would say that's a positive. I think you also have this interesting dynamic that's now starting not just at Oxfam, but in other companies and other entities, where it's, of course, in government, the analogy is it's the cover-up, stupid, right? It's not just the underlying crime. Here you have a situation where managers are being held to account. It does appear that this individual had been sanctioned before, that there was a pattern, a known pattern of complaints, misbehavior involving women. I saw that he put out a statement denying some of the specific allegations, but admitting to basically what seems like very inappropriate conduct in different roles in different countries around the world. So, you know, I think it's good that people are being held to account here, but it also reminds us, right, that there is very little transparency and there's very little set of what new normalcy is. What are the standards that we all agree for unacceptable workplace conduct and how to handle it when there is a violation, as there will be.
And also, if there are allegations about this guy before, the one in Haiti, and I think he also served in Sudan, if there are allegations, clearly you need better oversight. You need some sort of inspectors to go in and check out how things are going. You can't just let this thing go on, as apparently it did. Now, one of these individuals said he did have an intimate relationship with some woman in Haiti. He didn't take advantage of anyone, wasn't preying on minors or anything, or going to see prostitutes.
He said he didn't pay.
Exactly, right. So, right. But clearly, again, if there were allegations, whether it's at Oxfam, whether it's at some sort of a newspaper or any place else, if there are allegations, if you're in a leadership role in any organization, you basically have to say, something's clearly going on here. We have to do bend over backwards to make sure everything is done right.
Absolutely. But I think the tragedy of the Oxfam scenario is not just a Hollywood predator like Harvey Weinstein that you say, oh, I'm going to boycott his movie not to see it. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people's lives. These aid organizations are vital in third world countries, whether it's Chad or Liberia or Haiti or elsewhere. And they actually, the implementing partner of the UN and the EU, they have enormous amount of budgeting. And these people need need this kind of organizations. The problem now is the lack of confidence in them. Like, most of them depend not just on government donation, but also on individuals, on charity. And many people now start saying, well, if I'm giving my money to Oxfam, how do I guarantee that it's not going to go to this director that is using it for sex parties in Haiti or God knows where, or on prostitutes? So it's just not tarnished the name of aid organization. And I think it came to light, Susan's precisely described it, because of the Me Too movement, that we now cannot tolerate any kind of sexual harassment or exploitation of women in particular in third world countries. So, but the problem now is, how do you bring transparency to these organizations? And it's not just, by the way, the NGO world, also the peacekeeping. I mean, in other part of Africa as well, in Congo, in Chad, elsewhere, and these members, they considered member states. So you have the UN to look into that. And now it forced the Secretary General to say that sex exploitation is a crime and we have to fight it. So it's good that it came to light, but I think it will affect so many people's lives. And it's, in a way, it's good to talk about it. It's very tragic, and it's very touching to see actually the director resigned and apologizing, etc. But we'll see where it's going.
And what's particularly troubling about this, of course, is they're preying on the most vulnerable people.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Earthquake
yeah.
victims, natural disasters, wars, or famine. It's just despicable.
Absolutely.
Let me hold you right there, and we got to shift gears to the Olympics before our time is up with a bit of an international take. The first full week of the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea. There seems to be a little bit of detente between the North and the South, both countries marching under one flag, which brought some hope that political tensions might be lessened. North Korea's dictator Kim Jong-un invited South Korea's president to Pyongyang for what would be the first summit between the leaders of those nations in more than a decade. Some Korea watchers are tepid about this overture. They caution that it might or might not be viewed as a diplomatic breakthrough. Susan Glasser, I know our time is short, but what about that? How are we viewing relations with North Korea, especially because Vice President Mike Pence kind of gave North Korea the cold shoulder?
The cold shoulder and then some, right? I'm sure everybody remembers that extraordinary image from, was it just a week ago, of the vice president studiously ignoring Kim Jong-un, the dictator of North Korea. He sent his very telegenic young sister to represent him at the games. She's sitting there in the same box with Vice President Pence, who is doing his best not to look anything other than frozen and indifferent to her presence. They're calling it the Olympic opening. I do think that it was probably a smart tactical play on the part of Kim to send his sister and to participate in the unified team. But I agree with you that North Korea watchers in general are quite skeptical that this will lead to any kind of significant breakthrough, in part, of course, because of the puzzling and contradictory signals that have been sent by Washington over the course of this last year. Remember, not only have we pledged fire and fury, and President Trump has taunted the North Korean leader, but there have been very wildly diverging signals, including in the last week, about whether we were even interested in holding talks. In the last week, it sounds like we're saying, yes, we are interested in holding talks, but that may well be an effort simply to co-opt the appearance of the South Koreans operating on their own to talk with the North Koreans, which is something that the United States does not want there to be an appearance of a wedge and a division between us and our allies in South Korea and Japan. So again, I think, you know, basically most experts are saying it's going to take a little while for this to play out because there's the Olympics and there's the Special Olympics. So basically you're looking at sometime later the spring in March when we'll know more clearly. And one thing to watch for is whether or not the United States agrees to postpone its annual military exercises with South Korea, which is something that the North Koreans want as a show of good faith.
Another thing, well, you see more missile tests coming out of North Korea after the Olympics come to an end. And what's significant, I think, is Secretary of State Rex Tillerson saying we can have talks without preconditions. Nothing may come of that, but it's important that people are talking, whether it's President Moon, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. You talk to officials at the Pentagon, what they say is, listen, we would like to see people talking, diplomatic openings, keep the sanctions going. as opposed to just having military exercises, just having missile tests and building the nuclear program. They would like to see people talking well into the future as opposed to people talking about going to war.
Mm-hmm. I know we're low on time, but just an update on the medal count. Currently, Norway leads the medal count with 19 medals. Six are gold, followed by 15 for Germany, 13 for the Netherlands. The U.S. is fifth in the medal count with 8 medals, including 5 gold. One quick controversy out of NBC. It cut ties with a former analyst, Joshua Cooper Ramo, because of a controversial comment he made during the opening ceremony.
And now representing Japan, a country which occupied Korea from 1910 to 1945, but every Korean will tell you that Japan as a cultural and technological and economic example has been so important to their own transformation.
That set off some anger over the remark. He later apologized on social media saying, quote, "I did not intend to minimize or disrespect a part of Korean history that must never be forgotten," unquote. Susan, what about this? Is this something that how much did this resonate, and how big a deal is this? It is
a big deal. I mean, remember, there are continuing fights every year. I'm sure we've all read a million versions of the story about Japan refusing to apologize for the role in exploiting and enslaving thousands of Korean women during World War II, the fight over the textbooks in Japan and their misrepresentation of this history. So this is the source of the sore spots. And by the way, coming at this moment of national pride for South Korea and hosting the Winter Olympics, but also at a time of real existential anxiety about this aggressive new North. And is the United States going to sell us out and you know, go to war to protect Americans and end up hurting us? So it's a really fraught time.
I know people in our country don't really study history as much as they should, but for someone to make that kind of statement is almost stunning. And that guy should clearly just stick to sports.
I have to say, I picked a really weird weekend not to be in Washington with the three of you. I can just kind of wind you up. And all I have to do is just say, Syria, go.
Yeah, we have and more to say on
we
Syria. Don't,
we haven't even talked about Ethiopia.
We'll come back, next week and we can do 3 hours on it, Joshua, if you have the time.
If you got time, we can keep rolling.
We haven't talked about Turkey and Russia enough. I think we should keep going.
Yeah. We will get there. Yeah. We will get there. NPR Pentagon
Morgan
correspondent Tom Borman. Tom, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
Susan Glasser, Chief International Affairs Columnist for Politico. Thanks, Susan.
Thank you so much, Joshua.
And Nadia Bilbasi, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya. Thank you, Nadia.
Glad to be here.
What a great time we've had here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Michigan Radio, a phenomenal station. Thank you for hosting us these last few days. This program does come to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. We're hitting the road, heading back to Washington. We will be back at our home base on Monday. But until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.